Yeah, House Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology for Tuesday, May 8, 2007, to order. The calendar today, we have four bills, Senate bills, that we're going to hear, and I'm going to hear them in order, just the way they are on the sheet. So I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on the Senate Bill 687. Want to tell us about that one, Patrick?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 687 exempts from the Oregon Insurance Code businesses that are arranging for or transporting and preparing human remains for return from the place of death to the place where they are to be buried or cremated. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact and moved through the Senate on a vote of 28 to 1.
So we get all the fund bills in this committee. Would David Shorter come forward, please? Yeah.
I have some written testimony to submit here.
Great.
My name is David Schroeder. I'm with a company called International Emergency Assistance. And we put this bill forward. And our company, what our company does is simply a facilitator of transport arrangements in the event somebody passes away while they're traveling far from home. And we market our services through third-party marketing companies such as funeral homes, cemeteries, and other third-party marketing companies, employee benefit programs, et cetera, et cetera. And when we were offering this about a year and a half ago or so, we were contacted by the insurance division, and we had several meetings with the insurance division following that contact. And the insurance division determined that at that time what we needed to do was apply for an exemption from their insurance code, because they said that the insurance code, the definition of insurance, is so broad in the state of Oregon that it appeared that our program might be considered insurance. So we had a number of meetings with them and asked them if they would be opposed to having us add an exemption in the insurance code, and they said no, they would not. As a matter of fact, Carl Lundberg from the insurance division testified not opposing our bill in the Senate about a month ago. And so we're here just to answer any further questions that you might have relative to that.
Great. Questions?
I just want to clarify. They were considering your company, what you do as a business, as insurance?
They did not for sure, but they said that they may have to do that, because what we do is we sell, or we don't sell directly, we sell through third-party marketing companies such as funeral homes and cemeteries, our program. And our program consists of entering your name into a database. We have a 24-hour call center that's available to assist in facilitating transport of mortal remains back home in the event that they die away from home. And since we were, I believe, since we were basically saying that we will provide this service if it's needed in the future, that it might be considered a risk product. And so, therefore, they said the only way that you could continue to operate in the state of Oregon was to be added as an exemption in the insurance code.
And that's because you're selling the service in advance.
That's right.
And not at the time it's needed. So you may or may not actually ever provide the service.
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
The insurance code presently has, I believe, two exemptions, and one is for ambulance companies which sell similar type memberships, and automobile clubs.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's the only one listed for testimony. Is there anybody else here who would like to testify on this bill? Not. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 687. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 687. Representative Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 687 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Beyer moves Senate Bill 687 to the floor, do-pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 687 is passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Anyone want to carry that bill, or should we put it on the consent calendar?
I could move we put it on the consent calendar.
We're going to put it on the consent calendar. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 687. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 722 modifies the standard for review by Metro of comprehensive plans and land use regulations of the cities and counties within the district to determine whether those comprehensive plans and regulations substantially comply with the regional framework plan and functional plans. It establishes a process for enforcement of those requirements and authorizes imposition enforcement remedies by the district. This has no fiscal or revenue impact, and the vote in the Senate on this measure was 28-0.
Okay. We've got three folks signed up. I'm going to have everybody come at once. Pat, Jack, Randy. Whoever wants to start first, go ahead and introduce yourself. And
Chair Riley, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torque, appearing today on behalf of the city of Hillsborough. I'm joined today by Patrick Rebellia, Senior Project Manager for the city of Hillsborough, and I will let him speak to the substance of the bill. I would just remark at the outset that this bill is the result of a substantial amount of work and effort between the city of Hillsborough and Metro during the interim to discuss and review regional plan framework compliance under the land use law. We bring this bill forward together, and this bill has met with has been vetted with the 25 cities that are members or that exist under the Metro Regional Government, and there's no opposition to the bill that we're aware of, and as Mr. Brennan said, it passed 28-0 in the Senate. With that, I'll allow Mr. Rebellia to speak to the substance of the bill.
Thank you, Jack. Chair Riley and committee members, for the record, Pat Rebellia, Senior Project Manager, City of Hillsborough. Mayor Hughes sends his apology. He was called away on a quick emergency meeting, actually this afternoon, city business related. But a copy of his testimony, written testimony, I think, has been circulated. So I won't go into the details, but I'll just sort of highlight the main point of the testimony.
Could you move the microphone back a little ways from you?
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. The key point of this bill is that it would allow a county or a city and the regional government, in instances where strict compliance or literal compliance with the regional functional plan requirements would create difficulties either at the regional level or at the local government level, to find a collaborative work on solutions that would be mutually beneficial. The relationship between cities and counties in the region and the Metro government has evolved to the point where and matured to the point where on issues like this they need something like this bill to allow them to find ways to work out mutually beneficial solutions and to issues, compliance issues. We have three counties and 24 cities in the region, and each of them are unique in its local planning priorities, and oftentimes some of those priorities rub against some of the regional priorities. This bill will allow the parties to find mutually beneficial solutions. With that, I will stop there and answer any questions if there are any.
Well, let's hear from Randy first, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, excuse me, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Maybe I'll be uncharacteristically brief. We'll find out. Unlike Representative Girard, who's always brief on the floor.
At least he says it.
He says it, yes. Well, I often say that when I start my testimony, but it doesn't end up being brief, so I'm hesitant. Let me just say, this bill provides, it just helps to clarify the limits of where regional authority ends and local authority begins, or you could look at it the other way. And it arises out of a dispute that embroiled the city of Hillsborough and Metro for a couple of years and spilled over into the legislature last session. I think we've told you all the story individually, and we told it over in the Senate. It's with great pleasure that I can appear before you today in support of mutually supported legislation to resolve that dispute. I think it does help to clarify that Metro can be more flexible in the application of its regional framework plan at the local level, and in return for that flexibility, provides us a little bit more leverage when there are communities within the region that are just refusing to comply. And it would be a pretty blatant refusal to act that would trigger any of the enforcement provisions of this bill, which really is something we haven't had to use, and certainly it's not since I've been working at Metro, and I think in several years have had to ever even think about this sort of thing. So really, I think the key is up to the bill is providing a more flexible approach to working out the compliance, as Mr. Abelia discussed, and we're in full support of the bill. The council is happy to, my Metro council is very happy to be supporting with the City of Hillsborough, Senate Bill 722.
Thank you. Questions? Well, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 722? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 722.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 722 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves Senate Bill 722 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Place on the consent calendar.
And place on the consent calendar.
And is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. We received the required majority. Senate Bill 722 is passed to the floor with a DuPass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 722. Do you want to do a vote on this bill?
Yeah. There was no opposition.
Reopen the work session on it?
Yeah.
If that's
what we want to do. Yeah. I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 687. Do you have a motion?
I do. Mr. Chair, I request we suspend the rules to allow Representative Girard to vote on Senate Bill 687.
Representative Beyer requests unanimous consent that we allow Representative Girard to vote on Senate Bill 687. Any discussion? Any objection? How do you vote, Representative?
I vote aye. And thank you.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 687. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 699. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 699 permits the Legislative Administration Committee to prescribe and the Department of State Police to enforce parking regulations in the areas immediately north and south of the State Capitol Building. It specifies requirements for the citations issued for violations, and it also excludes areas immediately north and south of the State Capitol from control by DAS. This measure would take effect upon signature by the governor, And there is a fiscal impact statement attached to your staff measure summary. And one other thing I should mention, the vote in the Senate was 30-0.
Dave Henderson.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, I'm Dave Henderson, legislative administrator. Thank you for inviting me to be here today. It became apparent in the last interim that the state police did not have the authority to enforce parking regulations as they relate to two areas immediately adjacent to the Capitol. We're talking about the area in the front of the Capitol that you actually pull off of Court Street, so it's about a dozen parking spaces in that area, and then on the State Street side of the building, it's about half a dozen parking spaces right outside the center doors on State Street. Consulting with the state police and DAS, we felt that this was the approach that would allow the Legislative Administration Committee to adopt parking regulations, and it would authorize the state police to enforce those parking regulations.
Questions? Yes, sir. Kendrad.
Dave, as far as the other parking spaces around the block, that's all monitored by the City of Salem. Is that not correct?
Chair Riley, Representative Gerard, that's correct.
Well, just out of curiosity, why can't the City of Salem do this?
Chair Riley, Representative Gerard, it's state property as opposed to the other parking, which is city property.
Mm-hmm. I would like you to repeat that question and answer for Representative Thatcher.
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, the question related to why the city can enforce parking in areas around the building other than the two areas covered by this bill. It's my understanding that on the street parking, that property is controlled by the City of Salem, owned by the City of Salem, whereas these two areas covered by this bill, this is actually state-owned property, so we need to have it enforced by the state police.
And would you quickly define those two areas again, please?
Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, those areas are on the front of the building, the area where you pull off of Court Street, and actually there's an island between the parking and the street. And then on the back side of the building, it's about half a dozen spaces right outside the center doors on State Street. There's a painted island there. It's not a physical island, but there is a painted island there.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else on the list? Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 699? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 699. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 699.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 699 be moved to the floor with a due pass for recommendation and placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Girard moves Senate Bill 699 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar. Any discussion?
Well, I'm glad that the City of Salem's revenue won't fall down around their ears if the ticket Nazi. Did I say that out loud? if the person that is very good at their job is you know, bringing in the revenue. Okay, that's very few spaces that are affected.
That's correct. Yeah. Call roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 699 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 699. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 753A. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 753A requires public bodies to cooperate with and promptly provide information to ombudsmen's established by law or designated by the governor. It requires persons contracting with a public body to cooperate with and promptly provide information to an ombudsman investigating matters related to a contract. It requires the agency to offer officer of an executive department to consult with the Attorney General regarding legal disputes related to ombudsman requests for information, and provides that information provided to an ombudsman is confidential and that there is an option to decline the request for inspection of public records.
Thank you. Senator Marsat, thank you very much for gracing our committee. And
thank you, Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Marsat, Senate District 6, parts of Lane and Linn County. I live in Springfield. this is a bill that helps to clarify the role of the ombudsman or ombudsperson, as we should probably change it to. But there is an amendment that there is a glitch that we're going to have to deal with in just a minute. But the purpose of the bill is to make sure that the information is readily available on request of the ombudsman from the department, and that the the language was reviewed and drafted by the Attorney General's office, and Pete Shepard is here, who will also discuss what we see as a glitch in the bill that should be fixed. So with that, I would turn it over to would you like to?
Good afternoon, Chairman Riley and members of the House Government Accountability and Information Technology Committee. My name is Naomi Steenson. I'm the administrator for the Governor's Advocacy Office, the Department of Human Services, and Children's Ombudsman, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 753. The Governor's Advocacy Office serves as an ombudsman for all of the Department of Human Services programs and services, and the role that ombudsmen in general play in state government is invaluable for ensuring that Oregonians are given a neutral and unbiased investigation or review of their complaints about program benefits and service. Oh, excuse
me. Could you move back just a little way from there? Yeah, these are very sensitive, and you need to have a little distance.
Okay, I'll be distant.
Thank you,
and excuse me on that. The ombudsman offices do serve as a tool for state agencies and other entities to hold them accountable to their mission and policies. And the level of service that we can provide the individuals who seek help from us is precisely dependent on our ability to get the cooperation and response from whichever relevant agency in providing us with the necessary information and documentation. Although the Governor's Advocacy Office is fortunate to have a lot of access to online client information systems, in many cases we do have to contact contractors and such as the local mental health authority or the county developmental disability services. And we do encounter cases where there's a lot of hesitation or resistance to respond or provide the requested information. And it becomes either an educational opportunity or we're compelled to go to a higher authority to mandate that cooperation. Our history has shown that as much as we show respect and fairness to these agencies, it does build trust and foster future cooperations. But we evaluate the cases for compliance to the policies, fair treatment, and due process, and even look to the impact of how staff treat the individuals and demonstrate regard and respect for them and their concerns. And finally, we do offer an unbiased second level review of our perception of the events or actions that have taken place and move on for outcome or resolution. Another principle of Senate Bill 753A grants ombudsman the statutory authority to decline to provide records or information in response to requests made under ORS 192410 to 192505. Although this is vital, I would request that for line 23 and 24 of this bill, as Senator Morissette mentioned, that we could delete the part about communications as being confidential, because it could be interpreted that all communications to ombudsman are confidential and they may not share any confidential information. And for the purpose of investigation or information investigations, excuse me, or intervention, it might be crucial that the ombudsman does share confidential information. But the bill should specifically continue to ensure the ombudsman is having the discretion to decline disclosing communication or information in response to those statutes. And I do have a couple of examples where the governor's advocacy office was subpoenaed for records and what the impact was. And the first was a mother with mental illness whose parental rights were about to be terminated. She sought help from our children's ombudsman and was very, very distraught and desperate and made a lot of inflammatory comments and bizarre allegations and threats, which we recorded in our files. Then, prior to her pending court date for termination, our files were subpoenaed by the local district attorney's office. And although we didn't support the mother's position in the matter, we were appalled at the fact that here she had come to us to ask for help, and now our records of conversations with her were going to be used against her. And one other case was a state employee in good faith reported a serious wrongdoing to our office regarding another state employee. This prompted an investigation of the matter, and the reporting employee was very fearful and asked to remain anonymous. The other employee who was the subject of the investigation, after they left state service, they subpoenaed our records in order to file a lawsuit against this employee. In both of these cases, we made appeals to avoid turning over these records, but we had no legal standing to refuse. So in the mother's case, general counsel did step in and prevail on our behalf, but in the employee's case, we were forced to produce our records. So in closing, both of these elements of the Senate Bill 753 are imperative in the kind of work we do and in terms of the people we serve and giving them reason to continue to believe that the system works and that we can continue to uphold public confidence in how our systems work as well. Thank you for your consideration.
Whoever would like to go next? I'm going to hear from the entire panel before I take questions.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I am your state long-term care ombudsman. And what the long-term care ombudsman does is that we identify, investigate, and resolve the problems and complaints made to us on behalf of the residents of long-term care facilities. So we have a very small piece of the world, and it has to do with long-term care facility residents. Normally, our investigations are conducted in long-term care facilities, and the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman has a federal mandate and federal statutory language, as well as a state statute that enables the program that's embodied in 441-100-153. And so, basically, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman already does have access to the records of public bodies, and probably of all the long-term care ombudsman programs in the state, we would benefit the least by this legislation. But having said that, I recognize the importance of the legislation for ombudsman programs because information is really key to being able to be a good and appropriate and effective ombudsman, to have access to information. And what I like about the bill is that even though currently the long-term care ombudsman has access to the records of public agencies, often there are situations where you make a request for that information and the agency itself does not view that request as any type of priority. And so you may ultimately get the records that you request, but you may not get them in a timely way, or you may not get the response in a timely way. What I like about this bill is it puts front and center the fact that that agencies are to cooperate with the ombudsman and that they're supposed to provide information promptly. So that would, I think, go a long distance in terms of trying to enhance our ability to get to information quickly, because quite frankly, what we're trying to do is resolve these problems for citizens as quickly as possible. So essentially, the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman does support the bill. There is only one concern that we have for the language of the bill. It was referred, Senator Morissette referred to it as a glitch, and I think Naomi just talked about it. But there is on the Ayn Gross version of the bill, which is on line 23 and 24, section 3, where it says communications with an ombudsman and information provided to an ombudsman relevant to the duties of the ombudsman are confidential. That I would really urge you to have to consider deleting that language from the bill, because what it does is it puts inadvertently, and that was not the intention of the language, but it puts the ombudsman in a confidentiality box. And what that means is that even the people or the entities that the ombudsman are investigating can now use that the fact that the information is confidential to actually hinder the ombudsman's ability to use that information to resolve a complaint. So, for example, if I went into a facility, a long-term care facility, and a resident made a complaint to me that said that the food here is horrible, people are losing weight, and we haven't had anything palatable to eat in a matter of weeks. And I went to the administrator, and the administrator, in an unusual moment of candor, said to me, "Well, we've gotten instructions from the corporation to reduce the food budget to 50 cents per person per day." And, of course, this is only an example and is not taken from real life, but the point of the matter is that I could not then use that information. That administrator could use the provision of this bill to say that the communication was confidential. And I couldn't then use that information to try to resolve the complaint effectively for the complainant. So we would just ask that section be deleted as it is, and in its place has some language to the effect of, in response to requests under ORS 192.410 to 192.505, an ombudsman may decline to disclose information received pursuant to its duties, and simply leave the provision as that. With that, I'll close my comments, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Okay. Pete?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Some time ago, Senator Morissette asked for our review of what was then a concept with particular emphasis on the role of the Attorney General in the concept. The emergent Ayn Gross Senate Bill 753 is the result of began with those discussions, and we're fine. We support the way that the Attorney General's role is described in the bill. The Attorney General serves as the legal advisor to all state agencies, and so we would hope, even under existing law, if some dispute were to arise between an ombudsperson and a state agency or a state officer about access to information, and that were a legal dispute, that we would hope that that issue, if the agencies needed either of them needed legal advice, would come to us even under the status quo. This bill reflects that role and simply makes it clear that that's the role that we would play, a legal advisor to the ombudsperson and the agency in question. So we're very comfortable with that, the way our role is described in the bill. From a policy standpoint, the Attorney General has long had a concern and a role in helping to enforce and improve protections in the area of elder abuse. And in that effort, particularly the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office is an important ally and partner in that. And so we're generally supportive of any improvement in the tools that are available to her. And as you've heard, this bill does represent an improvement on the status quo as to her office. With respect to the lines 23 to 25, those amendments actually, although Senator Morissette credited our office with authorship of all of the language, I have to say we didn't author that language, and it actually emerged in the process in the Senate after without our review. I would In an effort to try and help the committee, I would describe what I think the current language, the language of the draft bill does, and then you can make your policy choices in relation to that. First, I think that as drafted, line 24 does impose a duty of confidentiality on the ombudsperson who receives this information. That's the confidentiality box that Meredith described. In other words, it says to the ombudsman that the information received relevant to their duties is confidential. And that could be read as imposing a duty to maintain confidentiality, even where it would be desirable for the ombudsperson to make use of that information in another forum. The next part of that phrase is perhaps the part that you'd want to consider retaining in the bill, and that is the expression that the ombudsperson may decline to disclose the communication or information in response to a request under cited statutes. Those cited statutes are the Oregon, that's the Oregon Public Records Law. And so the effect of the language that you have before you in the Angros version of the bill is that in response to a request under the public records law, the ombudsperson would have authority under the bill to decline to provide that information to the requester. As drafted, this language would not necessarily reach the kind of circumstances that Naomi has described. And that would be whether you want to reach the circumstances in which information is subpoenaed, say, as a result of a parallel civil action between private parties or in a criminal prosecution. Those, I would suggest to you, would implicate some other kinds of policy choices that may not want to engage. But as drafted, the phrase may decline to disclose the communication or information in response to a request under the cited statutes would permit the ombudsperson to resist a request under the public records law.
Questions? Representative Thatcher?
I'm sorry. We were hoping
Don't
to
be
get
sorry.
Here early, but I remember you saying that there was sometimes hesitancy when you're contacting, I guess, agencies or contractors. What was the hesitancy about? Was it about HIPAA requirements, or what was the basis for their hesitancy?
I think it might have been more of a cultural issue. Sometimes individuals that are part of these contracted, like a county or a local authority, sometimes believe they are not under the authority of the state government. Sometimes there's a little bit of a fence between the two groups, and often when we have contacted them for information, they have said, well, we're not going to talk to you until we've talked to our attorney first. And even though we've reassured them that we're fully covered under the umbrella of confidentiality, sometimes they've refused, and it's taken extra time and pulling in higher authorities to mandate them to present those records.
I guess a follow-up. Would this bill change any of that? Because it seems like I can see that still.
It would be something existing. We could show them right off the bat.
Another question. That's okay. What were the objections that were raised in the Senate committee? I noticed about a fifth of the Senate voted against it. I just wondered if there was any particular objections you could address.
Thank you, Senator Bill Morrison. Senator Winters, I'm not sure if she had read the bill thoroughly before we had the hearing, but she, and it was based maybe on my description of the role of the Attorney General in helping to settle disputes, and she wasn't happy with that explanation. And having served as an ombudsperson in the past, she felt that the Attorney General shouldn't be playing that role now. I think it was probably my fault by not stating that the role of the Attorney General is to respond to complaints or to differences of opinion between agencies. That is a role that the office plays, and I don't think I explained it that way. And so there was, actually they caucused on the floor and they came back and a number of people voted against the bill in support of Senator Winter's concern. I talked to Senator Winters later, and I apologized to her for not going to her and talking about the bill based on the fact that she had experience as an ombudsperson. I don't think she had a problem with the bill. I think she had a problem with my presentation of it and perhaps a misunderstanding. So that's why there was some no votes, and that really surprised me. And I guess the lesson is there is no such thing as a bill that's going to, you know, there's no sure thing when you're carrying a bill. And it's important to cover all of the bases, and that was one that I simply missed. I did not consult with her beforehand. So.
Further questions? Chairman Gerard?
I have two questions. One is there's no fiscal impact on this bill. So, and initially, I thought it was adding more responsibility, but more or less, you conclude that this is just clarifying language as to the authority of the ombudsman. Is that not correct?
yes, that was the intent of the bill. And originally, when I talked to Meredith about the need for a bill, and I raised the question, an ombudsperson is supposed to be able to cut through all the red tape. And is this, you know, that's the origin. It's a Scandinavian derivative of a position that was empowered to go right to the heart of the matter without having to, you know, be delayed and so on. And I said, does that work? And that then triggered a discussion on the clarification that would be very helpful in reinforcing that in the statute so there wouldn't be the delays. Now, this only includes a certain category of ombudspersons. I say person because I think that's what it should be. But the ombudsman, there are a number of ombudsmen who are appointed by counties and other organizations that would not have this authority. This is limited to the governor's
advocacy
group. Yeah. So this is a clarification. Basically, this is a clarification. It doesn't really add authority. It clarifies authority and also clarifies the role of the Attorney General, which doesn't really need clarification, and then the word confidentiality seems to have a double meaning. I guess that could be read as in inhibiting the flow of information.
And because and what you really mean is non-disclosure, is that correct?
Mr. Chair. You do mean, essentially what the long-term care ombudsman has is they have discretion over their records, and they have discretion about disclosure of information with a duty of confidentiality to complainants and people who make complaints and residents. So there needs to be flexibility given the ombudsman to use their, you know, authority responsibly in order to be able to fully investigate matters. And so sometimes an ombudsman wants not to disclose because it serves the interests of the investigation. Other times, disclosure better serves the interests of the investigation.
So to clarify, in my mind at least, what this is really asking is that you be exempted from the state the disclosure laws of public record. Is that really? Would you like to? Am I getting this right, Pete?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was. It's Mr. Gallagher's fault.
Yeah. Well, it's usually Mr. Gallagher's fault. So
distracted me at the critical moment. I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question.
My question was the last part of this about the what has been called confidentiality and probably shouldn't have been is really about an exception to the public notice or public disclosure laws.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's not how it's. It could. I gather that is. That's how Meredith would like the bill to be. That is, it would like it to be about an exception to the. To the obligation to disclose in response to a public records request. And so your description of it being a non-disclosure is really the most apt description, because the public records law is about the circumstances under which disclosure can be compelled. And so the alternative would be authorization that says to the ombudsperson in possession of this kind of information that in response to a public records request, the ombudsperson would not have to disclose. It would be a non-disclosure. Now, recognize that under the public records law, most of the exemptions exist as options for the public official who is holding the record. That is, very few of the exemptions command the public official to keep the information confidential. They generally authorize the non-disclosure, as you aptly put it.
Okay. Could I get the three of you to possibly work with Patrick to word an amendment that we can get from the LC? That
we'd be happy to help with that.
Thank you. Anything else?
Yes. Yes, one other quick question, just for my own record. There was a statement that you work for the long-term care facilities, or you work as an ombudsman for the long-term care facilities. That does include assisted care facilities, does it not?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Gerard, yes, it does.
Okay. I want to make it real clear that I'm a major owner in assisted care facilities, so it's important for me to declare that. And the second thing is, it's been brought up several times, we have a question on what we call them. And I'm just wondering if now's not the time to put the person instead of the man. I just got corrected on the floor. It's not workman's comp anymore. It's workers' comp. I'm kind of an old duffer, but I'm capable of learning. So is that something we want to address in this or not?
I don't think so. I think we will leave that for another bill. I don't want to get caught up in extraneous stuff at this point if we can help it. Did you have a question, Mr. Edwards?
Well, it's not a question as much as it is a statement. As long as we're defining in statute here who or which folks are going to be, we are going to compel the state agencies to cooperate with. Mm-hmm. When cutting through the red tape, perhaps we could add legislators to that list as well. Just wanted to have that on the record.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And if there's anyone else who'd like to testify on this bill. So it really was your fault.
Okay. Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'm sorry I was interrupted by Pete Shepard. I was up here testifying and I couldn't get here in time. I represent Tom Gallagher, represent the newspaper publishers, and we are just reading through these amendments as they came up today. I actually have a couple of questions for the committee, because I'd be happy to work with Patrick and the others to fix it. There is a section in 502, 190, 502 sub 9 that says any record that's exempt under any part of the law is exempt. So I think that's what we're trying to do in Section 3. The records that are already exempt under another exemption of the public records law would not lose their confidentiality because they're given to the ombudsperson. That's what I think is the direction that you're headed. Is that correct?
I don't think that's where we're headed. In my opinion, what I've heard is anything that is under the ombudsman's care, if you will, in their keeping, would be exempt from these. And that doesn't just include records from other agencies. It also includes testimony from witnesses or people who come to the ombudsman to seek their help. That's my understanding, and I see that Pete is nodding his head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what the clarification is should we be looking to put this in 192.502, which exempts everything an ombudsperson has? And then the question I'm going to be asking Pete of others is, if it is not exempt when it's held by another department or agency, does the fact that the ombudsperson now has it make that exempt under a different public records request?
And my opinion, and it's merely my opinion, but I think it'll be held up, is that it would only be the fact that the ombudsman has it is the only part that would be exempt. That if you went to the other department and said, do you have these records, and it was not exempted, you would be able to get it. That's my opinion.
And thank you. I think with those clarifications, we'll be able to work with this. And what you're trying to do is say the ombudsman's complete set of records are exempt.
Correct.
Because the ombudsperson has them and is using them to assist the person.
Mm-hmm.
And that it only is when they're in the ombudsperson's file are they exempt.
I believe that's the extent of the bill, right?
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify on this? Good. If you all get together with Patrick and work this out. Any other? Yes.
Yeah. I was kind of following up with what he was saying, and what kind of bothers me is, say that a division of the government is trying to hide something, could they then refer that to the ombudsman and have that, because it's controlled by them, exempt from public records disclosure? And that's not what we want.
No, it's not what we want. And in my opinion, yeah. Pete, would you come up again? Tell me if I got this right. In my opinion, the fact that it's given to the ombudsman does not remove it from the records of the department of government, and therefore it doesn't exempt it. But it would still be under the public records law in that department. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first I would say, as to the language of the printed bill, I don't think the answer to that question is entirely clear, and that's one issue that we ought to address before we return to the committee with a suggestion.
What about intent, then? Or what you intend to do in the bill before it comes back to
us? Well, again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this particular part of the bill is not a part of the bill that the Department of Justice previously reviewed. And so I would defer to others as to the policy aim of it. What I can bring to the working group is some expertise on the public records law itself. And I think the questions that Mr. Gallagher has raised and that your vice chair has raised as well, those are things that ought to be, rather than left to interpretation, right, we ought to be explicit about it, so you at least have a squared away policy choice to make when you consider the proposed amendments.
Thank you. And so you can use what I said as what I would like the intent to be of the amendment that you bring to me.
I understand.
With that, if there's no one else who wants to testify on this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 753A, and I'm going to adjourn the committee. Thank you very much.